Few words to prime the pump. So I've been talking about the foundations for a spiritual life, different aspects of development that we want to. You want to record that? Give it a go. Just clip it on. So kindness is obviously an attitude of the heart which allows for a lot of things to happen, a lot of good things to happen, because it's very open, it's very forgiving, it's very flexible. So whether we develop kindness for ourselves or others, any amount of kindness in the psyche is a strength, a power of consciousness. And in Buddhist texts, kindness is described in so many ways. One of the ways it's described is that all of us have been mothers and brothers and sisters and fathers in past lifetimes. We're all very closely related. And the cook, Mickey, he looks like my dad. So the first time, I've said this before, first time I saw him, I wanted to hug him. Of course, he might have said, hey, wait a minute, whoa. But it just like taking that perception and then seeing what the connection is, and then dropping, you know, what was seen in a past life and going off into thought, but just developing that heart connection and then expanding that to all beings. And that's what we're trying to do in the kindness practice. So we try to get that sense of connection with any person, a pet, so it doesn't really matter, just the sense of openness, kindness, affection, sensitivity, caring, where the heart opens in a non-judgmental, non-critical, generous way. And that can be, anything can trigger that. But the trigger is not so important. It is important, but what's more important is that that's an aspect of consciousness which is wholesome, which is skillful and should be developed. And then it's very important to, I think especially in Western culture where there's a lot of self-criticism, to bring that into one's own heart, into one's own psyche, into the way one relates to one's own mind and body. So may I be well, may I be free from suffering. And that's something you feel in your heart, you feel as a mood. It's not simply in thought. It's not sort of parroting the phrase, may you be well, may I be well, may you be well, may I be well. I mean, it helps. It gets the whole ball rolling. But it is a heart connection. And we want to apply that to ourselves. It's not just about external things. Traditionally, in the practices of loving kindness or metta, you in the text, it says you begin with yourself. for Westerners, we're funny. We're sometimes it's hard to begin with ourselves. So it's helpful just to know what that connection feels like. So if you have it with an animal or partner or a teacher or a parent, what does that actually feel like? So you make that conscious by bringing up the image into your mind. You get a hold of that sensitivity, let go of the person, and then apply that to each moment, actually. That's what we're doing. In the practice of awareness, awareness should be conjoined with affection and kindness, because that's when we really learn, when we're willing to look at things in a generous way rather than in a gaining way, in a striving way, in a judgmental way. That always perverts our attention towards some kind of agenda that we have. And that's a huge part, I think, of good meditation, is the whole heart of kindness. So contemplate how you can touch that in your own life, what triggers are there for that, and then get a sensitivity, well, that triggers something that's actually always a possibility, and then manifest that more and more, make that more and more skillful. In talking about purification, cultivation, realization, there's other ways of talking about that. One of the ways is to talk about abandonment and development. Not abandonment as a child is abandoned, but abandoning the unwholesome states of mind. Abandoning, letting go of, giving up greed, hatred, and delusion, and cultivating wisdom, compassion, concentration, and so on. So the path is often defined in that way. There's abandonment of the unwholesome, and there's the development of the skillful. In the teachings are based upon causality, that the reason we suffer as human beings is because of causes and conditions. So the teaching is laid out quite simply: there is suffering, there is stress, as Ajahn Taneshwar says. There is the cause of suffering, the cause of stress. There's the end of suffering, and there's the path which leads to the end of suffering. We've all heard that before. Mm-hmm. Suffering has to be understood. The cause has to be abandoned. The end of suffering has to be realized, and the path has to be developed. The path to the end of suffering. So you have abandonment and development, those two going on. And because we can be mindful, because we can notice in time cause and effect, we can see how our actions create suffering or non-suffering. What kind of intentions lead to peace and what kind of intentions lead to confusion. We can notice that. So we can develop skills. We all develop skills. We can, and like Ajahn Kuslo, he's a collector of skills. He picks up one skill and he just hones it. So I've been watching him make Buddha rupas since probably 92 or so, any long time. And it just gets better and better, and he's got this production of Buddha rupas now, which are all over Ontario and the world. And so this one here, it's just that. Now, but just, he's really interesting to watch that way, because he takes a project, and then he just gets better and better on it. He develops skill. He sees cause and effect. He sees how air bubbles work and how molds work better or worse, or how, what kind of colors to use, and all the things he does. That takes a lot of perseverance, a lot of patience, and it takes observation, cause and effect. When I do this kind of a mold, what's the result? When I use plaster with this much water, what's the result? When I use more water, less water, so on and so forth. And that's if we didn't have that ability to develop skills, we couldn't really free ourselves from suffering. We just would suffer. But because we have that capacity, we can train ourselves. We can train ourselves to the wholesome, and we can train ourselves to abandon the unwholesome, the unskillful. So these suggestions of types of mind states and ways of practice are part of the whole skill base of Buddhist enlightenment, of Buddhist freedom. I keep mentioning the sense of devotion or respect or faith in the Buddha. One of the things that Western Western Buddhism has a lot of, it's a kind, it can be a very kind of secular Buddhism, can't it? Where oftentimes the teachings are given and the Buddha's sort of deleted, you edit that out. So a lot of places now teach without the Buddha, right? I mean, I hear about that. So that's interesting. It's not wrong, but what's interesting about Western Buddhism is the sort of the devotional side gets edited out a lot, because maybe as Westerners we've seen how institutionalized religion can be very superstitious. It can be just blind ritual. It can be the opiate of the masses, and so we have sometimes very negative perception of religion per se. Sometimes, huh? So one of the people I was talking to this group on Tuesday, he said, "Well, I don't think Buddhism's a religion. It's a philosophy, isn't it?" And he really wants it to be a philosophy. Please be a philosophy. Don't be a religion. There must be hope here. So the word religion has taken on very negative connotations, and for justifiable reasons. And even like in Buddhist countries, there can be lots of corruption, lots of superstitions, and lots of stupidity. So no institutionalized structure is innocent of that. There's that kind of history. But what I think is more important than just the word religion, so I think we have to just delete the word religion, because it's become such a pejorative word, it's not a very good word. What is it, when I notice Thai people, or Sri Lankan people, or Burmese people, or people who come from Buddhist cultures, or people who have a lot of faith, they have this sort of devotional side to them, which I find quite delightful. And this kind of generous side, which I think is very, very inspiring. And it's not that Westerners are not generous and we're not devotional, but there's that part of Buddhism has been really much cultivated in Asia. But then Asian folk see us and they say, well, these guys are meditating. And they actually think about the teaching. They don't just believe in it. So there is this lovely, I think, mixing of cultures where our sort of intellect, you know, churning away, how does this work, and that. And then the Asian folk, I've seen lots of Burmese or Sri Lankans or Thais pick up Buddhism outside of their home countries. Really kind of pick it up in the meditative aspect and that, which is kind of a neat convergence. So for those of us who don't have a devotional side, you might just contemplate, well, where would that be profitable or unprofitable in your spiritual practice? What would that devotional side of respect and faith and optimism and hope and all those sides of a devotional practice, how could that help your spiritual life? Without, again, requiring that you have to bow or you have to be a Buddhist and, you know, take on institutional labels. Not to do that, but what is it as a state of mind? How could that be helpful? Well, I find it helpful. I just find this the teachings of the Buddha being so vast, and so the powers of analysis that the Buddha had around the mind, and the teachings around ethical teachings like monasticism, just social teachings that he has, are really, really, just for me, they're just amazing. So I have this great reverence for the Buddha, obviously, because that's where I've got this outfit on. But it's not just about this outfit. You know, it's not they're just trying to replicate this batik or something. He's got a nicer fold than me. but it is something about being inspired by a being spirituality, by a being's teacher, by a being's enlightenment. Of course, I have had very good teachers, Ajahn Chah and Sumedha, so I've had a lot of inspiration in that way. And that sense of being, that sense of devotion, and having a physical object in a person where one can bring forth that goodness, that devotion, I think is a very, for me, it's a very healthy part of developing skill. The skillfulness of faith and trust and respect and those kinds of words and feelings in the mind. Respect for the Dhamma, devotion to the Dhamma. Now, devotion to the Sangha gets a bit tricky. Because if you take Sangha as being your average monk and nun, then you get very disappointed, because the traditional idea of Sangha is the Arya Sangha, the Sangha of attained beings. So if you should project onto me that I'm enlightened, you're in trouble. Because I've got my work to do, so please don't do that to me. Because then you'll do it to yourself. You know, you project onto a teacher. Ajahn Kusala was, I think, telling me that someone in Toronto, I was talking about rebirth. He said, well, I don't know. I've not seen past or future lives. Maybe it's true and I believe it. So I was just talking about belief as opposed to really knowing something. And I've met people who had psychic experiences of past lives and future lives and so on. I was just kind of being honest. Well, don't know really. I believe it, you know, but it's me. Don't really know. And apparently someone came to Ajahn Kusala very disappointed. He's been a monk so long. And that's the whole projection of Sangha being something holier than thou, right? And that's where it gets terrible. That's when you attach to people being a certain way, and when they're not that way, say, you have disappointed me. I mean, I'm just doing my thing. So that's the danger of devotion, of course, and we've seen that. So the danger of devotion is like excessive authoritarianism from teachers, blind belief without questioning, and all the problems that we have seen with the kind of guru worship of people. So in traditional Buddhism, it's meant to be the Arya Sangha, which is the Sangha of attained beings. Well, who's attained? Well, most of us, you know, we're not going to touch that, no thanks. I don't want to be labeled with that, because you just get all these projections. And so there's a sort of, it's really hard sometimes for teachers to be human, to burp and do awful things like that. So you don't want to go there. You want to see you want to see that the Sangha represents the aspiration to enlightenment. We can't be perfect, right? That aspiration, and all of us represent that by being here together, that aspiration. And that one can respect, and that one can have devotion too. But as for personality characteristics and greed, hatred, and delusion, it's much, much harder than I thought it would be in the beginning. It's a much longer path. So consider where have those devotional aspects gone off in culture? Where have they become blind belief and projections and that? But also, what is it about a mind that is just too cynical and too critical? Because the danger of a mind which just kind of takes on, if I just take on a teaching according to my own values, then it's Virodhamism. You don't want Virodhamism, do you? You want Buddhism. So this is the danger of a very critical or cynical mind. It just edits out what it doesn't want. But then why have a teaching? You just, I don't like that. Rebirth, no. I don't want to let go of that one. So I'll take 2.5 precepts. So it's a kind of designer religion which fits my ego, basically. So that's the danger. I mean, that's an absurd kind of extreme of that. But you want something difficult to reflect off of too, don't you? If it's just easy and one follows one's own habit patterns, where can the challenge be? So to have devotion to the Dhamma means to take the teaching and reflect on it. And if you don't agree with it, you know that you don't agree with it, but why? But if you don't know, if it just, like this man that was saying, he was saying he was agnostic about rebirth. But then in further discussion, he actually felt that anyone who believed in rebirth was like someone who believed in abduction by Martians. That's not quite agnosticism. It's a bit the other way. So it's okay to disbelieve, and it's okay to believe, but to know the difference between disbelief, belief, and actually realizing something. There's a huge difference. I can disbelieve, okay, I know I don't believe in rebirth. Or I do believe in rebirth, That's fine. But what can you actually know? And that's the Dhamma of the moment. That's what you can actually know. If you're psychic and you've had experiences of that, fine. It's a part of the teaching. So when I look at the teaching and my mind goes into disbelief, I say, yeah, but that's the teaching. And should I just follow my preconceived notions, or should I just let that speak to me too? And that's very helpful to reflect on any positions one has taken. Not that one needs to take a position on that. So maybe just consider what is that devotional side, and where does that come out? Sometimes, again, for Canadians, it comes out in the beautiful waters and trees and mountains of this country, where one gets a sense of awe and a sense of other than just me, my little ego. Maybe it comes out like that. But I think just to dismiss Buddhism as a philosophy would be kind of sometimes leaving it too much at the intellectual level. So just to kind of contemplate that, what that might mean for you. Probably one of the things where we fail as meditators is impatience. Impatience, or we don't have enough patience. Patience is so important. And I think it's important to observe how you make effort, because if a person is very, very good at getting things done, right? You're really good at multitasking and really getting to goals and getting it sorted out and finishing it off, then that might be very good kind of worldly effort. And some of that be very good as you meditate, but some of it might just be too striving. So I've got to get this, I've got to get there, I've got to get that done, and there's a lack of patience. And that's really the secret of meditation, is patience. Not like blind willpower. That, I guess most of you have had enough experience now that if you just willfully try to zoom up into Nibbana or wherever we're going, it doesn't work. Because the will without wisdom still functions from ignorance. So patience is the secret. And as you just use the word patience, like with one out-breath or one in-breath, what you tend to notice is the striving to get something. I want to get somewhere with this practice. I want to get a result. I want to get an insight. I want to get peace. I want to get jhana. I want to get sotapatti. I want all those little goodies that the texts talk about. And that very striving to the future is not akaliko. It's not timeless. It's bound by time. And time and ego are one thing, because it's me becoming something in the future. I'm adequate now. I have to go somewhere to get enlightenment. And that builds up the sense of self and craving and time and the whole schlamazel. Whereas just having the humility and the simplicity of just one out breath completely is meditation. That's it. But no, I want more. and just being able to be with one out breath, just really simple. So use the word patience. Just one out breath. And that brings the mind to presence, to stillness, and that's it. Present moment awareness. Then the connection with the body, really feel the sensations in the body. To really touch them, rather than be, you know how we can kind of be thinking and breathing? You know, we're kind of mulling something over, we know we're breathing, but that real contact with the body. So you get the contact, and then you're just patient with sustaining that contact for one in-breath, one out-breath. That's it. And your mind wanders off. And I got to try harder. Am I thinking too much? No. Just wake up. This is the way it is now. Establish the stillness, pick up the object, and just sustain with patience whatever you're doing, whether it's body awareness. And then that's the training. So it's not a training in becoming something, it's more like just training in constant balance. If you look at it that way, rather than getting somewhere, you're just that point of knowing the way things are, and sustaining knowing where things are with patience is the balance. So we're just training in balance. Rather than, I'm going to get balance tomorrow, you do it now, you do it now, you do it now. The rest takes care of itself. And then in skill, in the development of skill, you watch cause and effect. How, let's say, you suffer from sleepiness. All right, so you definitely lose your balance, you lose your head. Your head sort of falls off and how do I do this? How do you get balance back? How do you wake up? So you use a question, how do I wake up? How does sleepiness overwhelm me? What happens to my posture? What happens to my spine? What happens to my heart? What happens to my chest? What kind of thoughts are there? Where's the energy? Is the energy in the head? How can I get my energy down? That's a lot of thought, but it's not really in thought, it's in observing. So you become an adept at the hindrance of sleepiness. You learn about sleepiness until you know it inside out. And then if sleepiness comes, then you keep working with it because you develop the skills around it. Rather than just willfully trying to meditate and get rid of sleepiness, that doesn't work. Or you feel annoyed or restless or bored or even whatever it is, all these hindrances come up as you meditate, that's what you got to learn about, obviously. That's what's blocking the practice. And the skill is, okay, this is the mood of the mind. It feels this way. It affects my efforts in a certain way. And you get better and better at it. But might you, if you would really consider patience, there's patient endurance and impatient endurance. patient endurance is much more profitable. Just bring up that word, just be patient, nowhere to go, nothing to become, and be present. That's a very important part of the practice. If you stretch your legs a bit, then we'll do some sitting.